And what the topic of today's class is, well, it's a warm-up class. What is security and what is security engineering and what does that have as implications for this class? So what are we going to learn about in this class? What I want you to understand today is what is security engineering all about. As you may have guessed, it's about security and engineering. We have to understand what exactly that means. I would like you to understand why that is so difficult. I would like you to understand how security intertwines with the different activities in the software development lifecycle. And I'd like you to get an overview, an understanding of what you can expect in this class, so that hopefully you will be back next week. Okay, now, what is security? The standard textbook definition of security is essentially, well, security is about three or maybe four properties. CIA. Confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And the fourth will be non-repudiation. I'm going to say a word about non-repudiation in 1 second. So, the problem of confidentiality is secrecy. How can you make sure that only those parties entitled to see data can actually see the data? And there's two or three problems related to that question, because the first question is, what exactly does that mean to see, and what exactly does it mean to have data, right? So one example is if you take one bit out of an entire data set and you make sure that people can just see that one bit but not the rest of the data. Did we violate secrecy or confidentiality of that overall data set? Probably yes, right? And we will understand what specific definitions of confidentiality are. Because if you think about it, and that's the homework for you right now, because this is very easygoing here, you can think while I talk. Think about how you would define confidentiality. We'll get back to that point. Second question is integrity. Integrity is concerned with the question of how we can observe or enforce that data is not tampered with. So we may not care that data is not secret, so everybody can see it, but we do care that the data has not been changed. Okay, that is integrity. And as you may agree, this sounds like a totally different problem. And in fact, in many cases, it is a totally different problem. Who is using email encryption and signatures here in this room? Some of you. So it may be interesting for you to understand that if you encrypt an email, then what you do is you try to implement confidentiality for that email. If you sign an email with a digital signature, then you hopefully make sure that a violation of the integrity of the content of the mail can be observed. Okay? It seems more difficult to ensure integrity than to observe integrity, obviously, right? If you have a data set, you can just spit into it, and therefore you would have changed it. And this is something that in most cases you cannot avoid. But you may be able to observe that somebody has spat into your data. What is more important, confidentiality or integrity? Yes. Very good. It depends on the use case, because that is, of course, absolutely the case. Right? Banking data, you would argue, probably is good in terms of both confidentiality and integrity. Data that is being passed from sensors to processing units can be as unconfidential as it gets. What you want to have there is integrity in most cases, right? And that means that the context decides on what is important here. The third component of security, the third classical component of security, is availability. If you have a system that is supposed to provide data and that system is down, then it's not a very useful system, right? So if you have a web server, you would like to download something, but the server is dead. It's useless, okay? And the reason that is important, or the reason for that being important, is that it's comparably simple to take out one specific server. So there's attacks on servers that are not even so difficult to implement, but it's a very simple thing to do. Just make that server crash. Nobody can use it anymore. And then the system is useless. Okay? And that's the third component that we will have to look into. And what I'd like you to understand is that we are simultaneously talking about data and systems here, right? We're talking about the confidentiality of the system and the integrity, the confidentiality of data and integrity of the data. But then, of course, there will be software that somehow handles data. And arguably, you would like to make sure that that software, that piece of software that is handling the data, also is not tampered with, which is one of the bigger problems that we have today. Because you may not even realize that your system is doing things that it's not supposed to be doing. Because there's been some malware that has been injected into your Android applications, for instance. Yes, please.
Have you ever seen how data will be released to
system? I'm sorry?
I
You don't see how data availability relates to system security. Yeah. So if a system is not secure, then you can break into that system and you can make it crash, or you can shoot whatever processes is running on that system. And that means that the data is not available anymore. Okay? Good. And the last property that I've mentioned before, which is sometimes also mentioned as part of that CIA plus something list, is non-repudiation. And non-repudiation means that if you have done something, you cannot claim that you haven't done something. So in German, it's Unabstreitbarkeit or Verbindlichkeit. Why is that important? Because if the system realizes or records that you have done something, then maybe you'll be interested in making sure that it was really you who did that. And somebody else may be interested in seeing that if you have done something, you cannot say in hindsight, oh, that wasn't me, it was somebody else. Right? So we somehow want to associate a person or an actor who has executed specific events or actions in the system is associated with these events so that we can see who did what. And then, once we know who did what, we want to make sure that you can say in hindsight, oh, that wasn't me. I didn't steal that money, it was my sister. Yeah. So I have children, I know how that works. By the way, talking about blockchain, everybody is into blockchain, right? Blockchain is the second most sexy thing after deep learning these days. What is blockchain doing? What security property is blockchain interested in? Yes?
Integrity.
Integrity, absolutely. So we will briefly be talking about blockchain later on. There's also one more thing about blockchain, of course, that is important, and that is a distribution of trust, no single root of trust, which you would have in every other system. Because one of the problems that we'll be faced with is that every system somehow needs to have a root of trust, where you just need to say, okay, I trust this. And from that point onward, you can guarantee and prove and have whatever mechanism in place, but you somehow need to say, I'm starting at a specific moment in time. And blockchain is trying to avoid that one single moment of trust that we need. There's a few more properties that are related here. Auditability, so we want to make sure that we can see what is happening in the system in hindsight. Accountability means that we not just want to see what has happened, but we also want to be able to assign blame if something has gone wrong, or we want to associate the responsible with a piece of data. Privacy is something that is related. Security is not exactly the same thing as privacy, but of course privacy and security are related, so we will briefly talk about privacy later on and then more intensely during the course of this class. Privacy essentially is about the security of personal data, and that has some specific implications that we use that specific kind of data. And one element that is important to privacy, for instance, is anonymity. And we will discuss what anonymity is. Because if I ask you, can you please define what anonymity is, what would you say? You would say, aha, good problem. Anonymity means that I cannot reconstruct the person that was identified with a piece of data. Right? That is anonymity. Now, the bad news is that most approaches that we are aware of to implement that kind of anonymity can be circumvented, can be undone, in the sense that we can know in hindsight who the person was. So in other words, you may think, let's just remove the first name and the last name and the birth date and the birthplace of a piece of data, and then say, okay, no, this is sufficiently anonymized. Generally speaking, if you add more information to that, you can always reconstruct who that data belonged to. And that is problematic, right? Because we don't really have a good way of doing that, but we will be discussing different interpretations and definitions of anonymity. And again, now while I'm talking, you can think, what is anonymity? Good. I believe in terms of relevance, there's not really a lot that I need to say. Why is security relevant? Well, because there's all that private data that is flying around. There's all that commercial data that is flying around. There's all that government data that is flying around. And different stakeholders have different objectives in terms of ensuring integrity and availability and confidentiality of this data. Now, security is, guess what, becoming ever more important. And why is that? Because software is becoming ever more important. There's so many new technologies flying around. I just mentioned car-to-car communication or car-to-infrastructure communication. And that kind of very cool things require that the transmission of the data is somehow secure, that the storage of the data is somehow secure. And the problem usually is, and that is now already addressing that point of security engineering, that people mostly say, hey, what I care about is functionality. I don't really care about security. And if you think about it, if you were a customer or a user of a system, you would say, hey, I want this piece of functionality, and yes, it should be secure. You wouldn't do that the other way around. You wouldn't start by saying, hey, I want a secure product, and by the way, the functionality should be the following. Right? For obvious reasons, functionality somehow is more important here. And that means that also in different development processes or approaches at developing software, security doesn't play the role that it's supposed to be playing. So here's one example. Agile software development, right, is a technique that I guess everybody knows that is incremental. You organize your work in iterative ways. You do that in sprints and so on. And of course, if you do it the right way, then you think about security all the time, all the time, all the time. But of course, if you think about security all the time, then that means that you invest time. And now imagine that you are building an application, your favorite pizza delivery app, because nobody has had that idea before, you're implementing that system. And now you start implementing security, and it takes you 6 months to do that. Now imagine you have a competitor who does the same thing, but doesn't care about security. They will be done within 3 months. They will be on the market within 3 months. And because they are on the market 3 months before you, it's likely that your business is never going to fly, even though your system is secure. Okay? And that is really sad, because you have the better product, but the maybe not so good product is the winner on the market. And in the end, doesn't matter to be secure. In the end, it matters to be successful on the market, right? And that is one of the fundamental problems that we need to take into account, that we will observe over and over again. Time to market seems to beat many quality attributes of software, including security, but also including maintainability. If you say time to market is everything, why do you care about long-term maintainability now? You will say, that problem I will solve later. And that is a perfectly rational decision. Okay? Good. Now, that used to be the case. People start to understand that maybe also because of legal compliance requirements, it's important to implement security from the beginning, to think about security from the beginning. But that story that I was admittedly telling you in a somewhat black and white way is something that is important. People don't care about security as much because what they sell is not security. What they sell is functionality. And we need to keep that in mind. And we'll have long discussions about that topic because there's a lot to be said about that. Good. There's several threats to the security engineer, to the secure functioning of a piece of software. First one is vulnerabilities. We will understand that there's implementation level problems, also at other levels, in fact, that are hard to overcome. And once the vulnerabilities, the weaknesses of a system are there, they will be exploited. And because most systems are these days connected to the internet, it seems comparatively easy to attack these systems via the internet. And that is why this is problematic. And we need to understand what a vulnerability is, how we can classify them, and what we can do against them at what level. Because not every security problem that we have is a problem at the implementation level. We may have just started with a bad architecture, and then we are flawed. Okay? But we may also have bought a wrong library that is not vulnerable and we didn't update it. So it may be that the process of using these things is problematic. And that's something that we are going to understand here in this class. Good. And because everything is connected, there's always that incentive for different kinds of attackers to attack systems. Some do that just for the sake of it, because it's fun. I guess one half of this class is of that category. Some people do it to make money. Some people do it to do harm. There's cyber terrorism. There's plenty of different motivations that you could think of. And the problem of security engineering is to somehow make sure that your system is not vulnerable to that kind of attacks. And you should now ask, well, what the hell? What kind of attacks are you talking about? And that's exactly the problem. I don't know. There's so many, and of course there's a few well-known attacks, but we need to defend against all potentially severe or problematic attacks. And at the same time, we need to make sure that we are not too slow in terms of our development and that we are not too expensive in terms of our development either. And that's a trade-off that we will have to discuss. Good. Now, there's plenty of different vulnerabilities that everybody here has read about. We will get back to these. Expect more of these to come, right? They will be coming. By the way, then, interestingly, once these things are around, people don't care so much anymore, right? You would say, oh my God, this is really bad. And then things don't really change. That's strange. We'll also have to understand why that is the case. And again, I would like to stress that this is not just talking about security, but also about privacy. Now, the point that I would like to briefly expand on is that matter of trade-offs. Because you may ask, is it worth the buck? And is it worth the hassle? Because sometimes security technologies just suck. Who is riding bikes here in this, bicycles in this room? I am. Who is regularly wearing helmets? That's approximately 20%. Why? Because it's uncool, right? You don't know what to do with it. It destroys your haircut, which is particularly bad in my case. That's a real reason why I don't do it. Right? Now, the point is, we have that security measure in place, but somehow it bothers us. And if it bothers us, then we are not going to use it, even though, objectively speaking, it's crystal clear that wearing a bicycle helmet is the right thing to do. That's one idea. Problem is, often enough, if there's a security mechanism in place, people will circumvent it because they can. And this already teaches us that security mechanisms, often enough, are not perfect. And this is something to reflect upon. Do we want perfect security systems? And of course, the answer would be sure. Yes, as long as they are usable, maybe we should do that. But then I ask you, if you want perfect security, do you want perfect security in the rest of your lives as well? And the answer is, no, you don't care, because it doesn't make sense. Who has windows in their apartments? Everybody has. How difficult is it to smash a window pane? Not at all. Is that secure? No. The locks on your apartment doors will be opened by a professional lock pick within in between 10 and 20 seconds. I have had that situation once, so we somehow locked ourselves out. And then we called these professional services, and the guy came to open the door, for which we didn't have the key, at least not at the outside. And he said, please turn around so that we didn't see what he was doing. And then literally it took him 15 seconds, and he looked at us and said, wow, you have a great lock. That was difficult. 15 seconds. Yeah, same is going to happen to you. Now, what's the point? The point is, do we want full security? And there's plenty of metaphors that you could come up with here. Take a red light. Jaywalking is really bad, right? It's terrible. So in order to avoid that, what we absolutely should have is fences and walls so that people cannot walk freely. That, of course, is nonsense, right? We don't want that. And we somehow need to see the trade-off between risk. So why would anybody enter your dirty student apartments? And the cost of implementing safety measures or security measures. So how much would it cost to come up with unsmashable window panes that nobody wants, actually? Or how much would it be to come up with walls and fences to make sure that people don't jaywalk? And we somehow need to think about these things, okay? So in other words, what I want to tell you is, yes, security in one sense is absolute. There's a few things that just shouldn't be happening. But then on the other hand, we should be willing to take risks. Why? Because it's not very likely that somebody will do whatever. There's one story that I'm always telling students in this class, and that is one day my bike broke. It was dead. And then my brother-in-law gave me his bike. And that bike had a market value of, I would say, maybe €2.50. It was the shittiest, shabbiest bike that I had ever seen. But he told me, I give it to you because you're my brother-in-law. I won't give you the lock associated with it because it's too valuable. I need it myself. So I needed to go to some bike store and get a lock. And I bought a lock that cost me €20. Okay? Now the question is it a rational decision to buy a lock worth €20 for a bike that has a market value of €249? Yes. Thank you, because I did it. You are a very good student. I see good progress. Why? Price changes according to the situation. Yeah. So I would rephrase what you're saying. It's correct what you're saying. The point is, it's not just the market value, right? It's a matter of utility. How much worth is it that I don't have to walk 20 kilometers, but rather take the bike? Is that €249? In Uber terms, it's even less, right? It's even more, I guess. So that's the point. Now, we will need to understand that because this is something that is fundamentally problematic. We need to say, okay, how likely is it that something goes wrong? How bad is it if something goes wrong? And how much money am I willing to invest to avoid that risk or to mitigate that risk? So the point is 100% security is a nice idea in many cases, but we need to factor in practicality. And that's something that we will have to understand. And then there's another thing. I love Google Maps. Right? And when I drive somewhere in an area that I don't know, I always use Google Maps. Because it's, in my opinion, just fantastic. Who uses Google Maps here regularly? Everybody, right? But guess what? They are taking out your data. Isn't that grave? Isn't that problematic? In a certain sense, of course, it is. But then what I do is I weigh functionality against privacy. And I say, well, for me, it's worth it. I'm not saying this is a very good decision, because we may argue that, hey, a company providing such a service should still not be able to use my data, my private data, in a certain sense, which, among other things, is one point of the GDPR, the new regulation of the European Union. But there is that trade-off between functionality and privacy again. Who is using Facebook here? Everybody, right? Oh, no, not everybody anymore. So what's the new kid on the block? Instagram? text is too difficult, right? We'd rather do photos. The point is, most of you will be providing data about private matters, while at the same time arguing, these evil people at Google, they don't respect my privacy. And we may want to think that there's a certain contradiction in terms here, right? So we'll have to consider that as well. What's the point? The point is there is that trade-off. And we also need to understand ourselves. Do we care? And why do we care? Or should we care? So do we really want that privacy? And in many cases, the problem is that the risk of privacy breaches is very abstract. If we take that question of the bike helmet again, you may wonder, why don't you do it? And I told you, because it's uncool, doesn't look cool. Or it destroys your haircut, again, which would be the case for me. Now, why don't we care? Why aren't we rational and say, hey, the risk of having an accident is there. It may be small, but it is there. And there's a high chance that we are going to be severely injured. Why don't we care? And of course, there's plenty of responses to the question, but one response is because the risk is abstract. Specifically for young people, the risk of getting hurt is something that, you guys are young, right? Why would you get hurt? You don't know what sickness is, and that's good. Of course, some of you do. I'm very much aware of that. But generally speaking, the younger you are, the less close you are to topics of that kind. Because it's only when you're a bit older that you see people dying and so on. Okay? So the risk is abstract. And why am I saying that? Because I believe the same is true for privacy. Why should we care about our own data? And one of the prevalent responses there is because we don't want Big Brother. And that's certainly true, right? But what is Big Brother? What does that mean? Is that Orwell's 1984? Is that social credit systems in China? What is it, right? And this is now getting more concrete with the last example that I have given there, but I'd like you to understand that the risk somehow is abstract, and this is one of the problems of both security and privacy. Until very recently, CIOs of companies used to say, show me that there's a business case in investing in security. If I invest $100,000 or euros, tell me that investment is worth 100,000 euros. Homework for you, come up with a convincing argument. It's going to be complicated. Same, by the way, is true for testing, right? Argue why you should invest 100,000 euros in testing. And then make sure that somebody gives you that money for that. So it's really complicated. Don't mistake me, right? When I'm making these somewhat sarcastic comments here, I hope you get me right. I'm not saying that we shouldn't care about security. I'm not saying we shouldn't care about privacy. What I'm saying is there is a line of argument that I can relate to, even though it is not my line of argument. And then there's, of course, the question, well, how do we balance privacy and security needs of single people with privacy and security needs of an entire society? So you may argue, well, I want absolute freedom for everybody. Nobody should be able to see whatever you are doing. But that, of course, means that you may put society at danger in terms of terrorist incidents, for instance. And then the question is, that's also not what we want, but maybe we should be able to see a bit what people are doing. Because we want to make sure that society as such is being secure. And then you have to trade the security of the individual or the privacy of the individual with the privacy or security of society. Again, one of these trade-offs where there is not the right answer. And we are currently having these discussions everywhere. Right? Upload filters, for instance, are along those lines. Accountability in social networks. Should we know who posted what? is absolutely along those lines. Because if we can see who came up with hate speech, we can also see who was maybe communicating in channels that are concerned with whatever flavor of sexuality that society may not deem appropriate. Right? And then there is that trade-off that we need to discuss. And the funny thing about that is, this is a not technical concern, right? This is a societal concern. This is much more than technology. And while I'm going to concentrate in this class on technology, because guess what? We are in a department for informatics. I'm absolutely aware that many of these elements that we are discussing here transcend technology by large. Because the problems are not just technical in nature. Now, in terms of technology, there's a few things that we can do and that we're going to learn about. We will learn about how to engineer such systems, right? There's a few principles that we're going to discuss. There's, of course, cryptography. There's different mechanisms for security at the physical level, both at a macro level and a micro level. We can use biometric technology. There's processor technology that may be more interesting than some other technology. There's formal approaches at designing languages in a secure way so that there is no information flowing. We can have operating system security, communication security, plenty of different things. Okay? And we're going to touch upon those in this class. But there's more. For instance, security that is related to organizations. There's that cliche of everybody putting post-its with their passwords on their screens or under their desk mats. Now, guess what? This is not a cliche. It's just happening. So I've seen that just recently in an organization where the people working in that organization were forced to come up with new passwords every 2 weeks, and they were not supposed to use the first and last three same letters as before. Because otherwise, my first password would be TUM is great. Then 2 weeks after that, TUM is great 1, TUM is great 2, TUM is great 3, and so on. And that's rather easy to break. Therefore, you shouldn't do that. And that organization was so clever to say, aha, we know that. Therefore, let's make sure that the last three letters or digits and the first three letters always are different. Now, guess what? That means that people have to come up with new passwords, really different passwords, every 2 weeks, twice a month, and they can't remember them. So what did I see in that organization? Post-its with passwords. Okay? So that is something that we need to understand. And there's plenty of other things. Somebody needs to classify which information is to be kept confidential at all. Surprisingly, that's also not clear. If you think about your own startup, I'm sure one half of you guys has their own startup. What's the confidential information in that company? You wouldn't know, right? You're not the only ones not to know. Security policies, so guidelines of how to behave in specific situations are there. Then people-related concepts, people need to be aware of problems. People need to be aware that phishing is working, right? You get an email telling you, please enter your credentials here. People need to be aware that impersonation, for instance, is working perfectly well. Most of us just see a person in uniform that looks a bit like a police officer, and we do whatever they tell us. There's plenty of experiments where people just put on a uniform, go to a building, tell them, I want to get in here now. Right? People are intimidated, leave them through. Is that a technical problem? No, not at all. How can that work? Only if you educate or if we educate people, of course. And then there's the legal side of the game. What about liability? If something goes wrong, who needs to pay for that and how much? How can we cope with insurances? And so on. And in fact, one observation that people have made specifically over the last couple of years is that usually the problem is not technology but the human. I've just mentioned that post-it example before. I've mentioned phishing attacks. I've mentioned impersonation attacks. So another very well-working approach is to call somebody in an organization, yell at them, and tell them, hey, I'm the secretary of your boss, I need that data now. Most people will be so intimidated that they just send out that data. Is that technical? Probably not. What I shouldn't forget, of course, is this is that people are also programmers and they also make mistakes. That also just happens, and we will need to cope with that. Good. So that's several of these techniques that I have mentioned before. There's plenty of attacks that work much more efficiently and effectively at the non-technical level than at the technical level. But then there is dozens of problems at the technical level, vulnerabilities we call them. So we will later understand what exactly a vulnerability is, but for now, a vulnerability is a weakness in a technical system. And then there's plenty of things that just happen. Weak passwords, right? 1, 2, 3, 4 as password probably is not the best idea. But even if you take a password that is 20 characters long, or maybe 10 characters long, but is a word, such as the name of your beloved dog, let's call it Rembrandt, for instance, then you may think, ha, how would anybody come up with that idea that it's Rembrandt? Well, there are so-called dictionary attacks that people use to find that kind of passwords, to break that kind of passwords. The idea, and I'm oversimplifying things here, is to say there's a list of words that people may be using, including Rembrandt, and then you just try all of them one after the other. And because machines are so fast, there's a chance that you can solve that problem just like this. So I can see some of you now changing their passwords. Oh, I shouldn't have done Rembrandt. Then there's problems in operating systems. There's plenty of security guidelines implemented in your operating systems, in Linux, in iOS, and in Windows. And you never see them. And you ought to not see them, because specialists should see them. But then who is taking care of configuring these systems? Right? Who is making sure that specific functionality is provided or not provided? Every functionality that is not strictly necessary should be cut off, because there may be a potential vulnerability in that kind of systems. Who's taking care of that? Are you regularly updating your software? Probably yes. You may know that operating system providers in the Android world usually decide after a few years not to support a specific operating system anymore, or not to support a specific phone anymore. And then what? Is everybody always going to buy a new phone? Of course, in that case, yes. Stupid example. But you get the point. You see what I wanted to tell you. And then there's a bunch of problems that is related to unchecked user input. And we will understand these things, and I guess most of you have seen them. They are also not terribly complicated. That if you craft input to a system in a specific way, you can use that to break into a system. And the two most important examples of that are buffer overflow attacks and SQL injection attacks. You can craft SQL queries that can be sent to a database server. And if you do that in a clever way, you can make sure that the database tables are being deleted. Okay? And in terms of buffer overflows, one easy way of trying to make a system crash is to just throw very long input at it. Try that with your own programs. Just throw 34K of ABCDE at the programs. There's a very high chance that they are going to crash. Okay? That's buffer overflow vulnerabilities. We will understand what exactly these do, but these are known problems, and of course we will understand how to cope with that kind of known problems. By the way, they continue to be known problems over time. Here is a list of these things. These are the newest numbers. There's no newer numbers than 2017. OWASP stands for Open Web Application Security Project, and they come up with classifications of what is problematic and not. And what you can see there is that these injection attacks, which is exactly what I was mentioning before, are number one. And interestingly, the problems are comparatively constant over time. So somehow there's problems that we are aware of, but we don't solve them. And there's a variety of reasons for that, because the attacks also get more sophisticated. But in many cases, it's because people don't update their software infrastructure, because they don't care, because what can happen? Well, if somebody breaks into my system, what are they going to steal? That's like the argument, hey, what is Google going to do with my data? What can happen? Now, please understand that I'm trying to be funny here, and I try to make you think that this is not the way you should look at things, but this is an argument that, by the way, in some cases may be perfectly reasonable. Right? Don't become paranoid. Good. And then there's also other statistics that show that the number of problems over time is significantly growing. This is just one number here that is showing how the number of vulnerabilities that we are aware of are developing over time. So I'm sure you can see that. This is here until 2015 or 2014, and you can see that there's a tendency of this number going up. So in other words, we know about specific vulnerabilities, and then we count the number of incidents that are related to the known vulnerabilities. And this goes up, which of course is explained by the fact that we have ever more systems. But then you may argue, well, if we know that there is a problem, why don't we fix it? If you know that you have to learn for an exam, that you have to study for an exam, why don't you do it then? Difficult. Good. And now security engineering, and then we'll have a small break here, is the idea of mixing engineering principles with information security. Okay? Software engineering, I'm going to read that for you, is the application of systematic quantifiable approaches to the development, operation, and maintenance of software. That is the application of engineering to software. Actually, in the last couple of years, I have come to believe or understand that cost should be part of these engineering things. Right? We need to do the right thing, but at a reasonable cost. Maybe I'm going to add that for Moodle here. Information security then focuses on methods and technologies to reduce risks to information assets, and then we can combine these two definitions to form a definition of security engineering. And this is from the most popular book on security engineering by Ross Anderson that you may find. Security engineering is about building systems that remain dependable in the face of malice, error, or mischance. As a discipline, it focuses on the tools, processes, and methods needed to design, implement, test, and evolve systems. And unfortunately, this is a discipline that is not very mature yet, but the few bits and pieces that we are aware of, I want to talk about in this class. Good. And because systems are becoming ever more complex, well, security engineering becomes ever more relevant. I suggest that we go for a small break of maybe 2 minutes so that we can refresh and stretch. Are there any questions so far? Is that a question or is that a stretch? That's a stretch. Good. 2 minutes.